Testing. Okay. So, as Virginia mentioned, my name is Daryl Brunch. I'm an Exchange developer here, and I'll be talking about Exchange Wraps. So, quick agenda for what I'll be talking about today. First, I'll just go over just a brief overview. If you ever looked at the MXOX CROPS document, there's over 100 wraps in it, so I'm not going to go into detail for each one of them, but just a general overview of how they're laid out. Next, instead of going through each one individually, I'll just talk about each section of them and kind of just give an overview of what's in each section. And then afterwards, I have a couple slides on just kind of the more advanced wraps. I don't know if they're really that advanced, but there are certain wraps that require a little bit more logic and parsing or serialization. After that, I'll just talk briefly about some of the differences between versions, and I'll end with just a quick sample of a buffer that goes between Outlook and Exchange, and Outlook startup. So just start with the overview. As Joel mentioned in the past presentation, the wrap buffers are a payload on the EC do RPC EX2 interface. The input from the client, so the input buffer comes from the client on the RGB in parameter. After all the obfuscation or unobfuscation and the uncompression occurs, then you get this large list of them. The format of the input buffer and the output buffer is the same in the way that you have 2 bytes at the beginning. You can either look at those 2 bytes as an indication of the size of the wrap list coming up, or you can view it as the offset of the server object handle table. After the size, then you get the list of wraps, and finally get this just a table of all the server object handles at the end. So once this buffer is parsed, you have to actually execute them, and all the descriptions of the behavior and possible return values are described in other documents as listed here. So as mentioned, for notification, the smallest wrap buffer you can actually have coming in is just 2 bytes, in which case the size is a value of 2, and there is no server object handle table. This type of buffer is used by the client just to give the server a way to return back notifications on the response. On the other hand, you can have a wrap buffer full of multiple wraps. And with the way that the wraps are laid out, with the way that the layout is for them, there's no easy way to actually skip past wraps you don't understand. So fortunately, from a server point of view, you effectively have to end up parsing every single wrap to be able to make sure that you don't miss wraps after these unknown wraps. On the client side, you have a little bit more flexibility in that you can just make calls to the wraps you know, and there's a handful of wraps you may need to understand from the server, such as wrap notify, pending, buffer too small, which may come back in addition to the response that you expect. If you've looked through the wraps before, you've seen that there's a lot of similarity between them. All of them have the same sort of header. Every single one of them starts with a wrap ID. All the request ones contain a logon ID and one or more handle indexes. And the responses are pretty similar in that they also start with a wrap ID. However, they do not contain a logon ID usually, but instead contain a handle index and a return value. So, as mentioned, the wrap ID specifies which wrap is in the buffer at that point. The logon ID and the handle index are used together to identify the server object that this operation is to be performed on. The return value is just the status of the operation. So one question could be, why exactly would the wraps themselves not contain the server object handle inside the wrap payload? Why have an index into the server object handle table at the end? The reason is this allows a little bit more pipelining of wraps. So for example, if you have an input-output wrap, so an example of this would be the create attachment or open attachment. In this case, you have a wrap that contains both an input and output server object handle table index. The input is the message where you want to open the attachment on, and the output is the place in the server object handle table you want to place you want the server to place the server object handle. This allows you to, in the same payload, put operations that then act upon the attachment you just opened. So one I guess, sequence of ROPs that I've listed here is you can have an open message followed by set properties followed by a release all in the same buffer. So in this case, the client doesn't even have to know what the server object handle is for this object. And this is just the example of one of the simplest ROPs I've seen. You have ROP reset table, which has about the bare minimum you can have for a ROP. You have the ROP ID for reset table on the top. For the request, you have the logon ID, and you have followed with the input handle table index, so pretty much the index to the table server object handle. On the bottom table, you see the response, which is also about the minimum you have. You have the ROP ID followed by the same input handle table index, followed by the return value, which is a 32-bit integer. So now I'll just quickly go through the groups of them. There's about 13 different groups we place these ROPs into. The ordering was, I think, just kind of the ordering we looked at them in Outlook. So logon ended up first because the first operation that the client needs to do is a logon to a mailbox. From that point, it can then perform other operations. So the logon section contains both ROP logon and other operations that only impact or only are performed on a logon object. Folder message are about the same. They contain the ROPs specific to creating, moving, deleting folders and messages. Tables are similar for contents tables, hierarchy tables, and once you have a table view, how exactly to navigate through it or query information from it. The transport section contains information about message submission and other operations kind of specific to transport, which is like the spooler and also some address information. Property and stream are both associated with the properties of objects. So if you have a message, you have a folder or logon, they all have the ability to query properties from it. In this case, if they're small enough to be able to be encapsulated in one payload, you can use the property methods. If they're larger than the 32K or 32K minus 1, then you're forced to use a stream where you can see different parts of it, different parts of the actual property. Permissions and rules are kind of grouped together. They're very similar to the tables in that you can open them, you can query them the same way, but setting information on it is slightly different. Unlike the, or I guess for a folder, if you want to create a folder, you use ROP create folder. If you want to create a message, you use ROP create message. For these, you have ROP modify tables. So you have modify permissions and modify rules, specific ROPs for just sending like add, delete, or modifications to the server. Next is the fast transfer, and next page will be synchronization. For fast transfer, these are just the operations that will be associated with the fast transfer streams. And as I mentioned, synchronization is for the importing changes and also the synchronization state transfer. Finally, we have the last two, notifications. So notifications mainly talk about the ROP register notification and also the ROP notify and ROP pending that comes back. And the other is pretty much everything else that didn't really fit someplace else. So now what I considered some of the advanced ROP parsing. So for the most part, if you looked at something like reset table, it was pretty easy to look through. You didn't have to know anything about the past state of the connection. You could just see it. You could see the ROP ID for reset table, and you know it was going to be 3 bytes long. There's other ROPs where it's not quite as easy. Some examples are there's about 4 ROPs that would require you to know the operations that occurred on previously on the table. This is something like set columns on the table would be needed to be able to parse some of the responses for these. So the example here, you have query rows, expand row, and find row. All three of these return back row payload. And there's nothing in this payload that actually indicates the size of each of the columns. First, you just have to know what the columns were set on this table beforehand to know. So if the columns were an integer followed by a string followed by an integer, you have to know when parsing to look for 4 bytes for the integer followed by a null terminated string followed by another integer. ROP notify I separated out just because it's slightly different than the other ones in that it actually does have a size in it. So potentially, if the client had already released the table, you could skip past it. So the parsing can continue on to the next notification. The last three, you have property list in the request, and that's for get property specific, very similar to query rows in that instead of looking at a table, you have to know the property specified in the request. For the read recipients, there is an extra property list returned back from the open message or open beta message, or I think reload cache information that would be needed to be able to successfully parse the result coming back from read recipients. And finally, you have ROP set message red flag, where the size of the ROP itself changes based on whether the logon is a public or a private logon. So the next two sections here are ROPs that aren't really paired at all. So you have only one ROP that comes in that doesn't actually have a response coming back, and that's ROP release. So the semantics of that is when the client issues a ROP release, there is no way for the server to return a failure. If the operation did fail, then the server just has to silently continue. For the next four, these are ROPs that may come back from the server that did not have an associated ROP request on the client side. So in this case, ROP backoff and ROP buffer too small. So ROP backoff indicates that the server is under load and would like the client to just come back a little bit later with the same payload, or whatever part of the payload had not been executed yet. So in this case, this could show up at any point in the stream. It could appear immediately, it could appear after all the ROPs, it could appear at the end. ROP buffer too small is similar, only it contains the payload. And you have a question?
Hi. What happens if somehow server doesn't receive for a particular handle, server somehow didn't receive the ROP release?
So you're saying what happens if the client never sends a ROP release?
Yeah, ROP release.
It depends if the client eventually releases the logon or releases the, or I guess disconnects.
So server basically holds on to that handle until it releases the logon?
Yeah. There's no garbage collection or anything like that, so.
Okay. And obviously, how does the handles are generally incremented, like monotonically incremented, or they reuse the handle IDs?
It depends on the version. I think there's 2007 and 2010 use slightly different versions. I think, if I remember correctly, 2007 might be more likely to reuse them, where 2010, I think, would just increase them.
Okay.
I mean, it'd be a while before it would eventually reuse them, but they could be reused.
Okay.
Okay. And the last two are ROP pending and ROP notify. These are notification-based ones. I guess we have another question.
On the ROP backoff, 2007, 2010, how does the server determine how long to back off? Is it like in terms of the time, milliseconds or seconds-wise? And is there like how many times, is there a limit on, does Outlook eventually give up if there's a ROP backoff and retry the operation?
Yeah, I don't know the specifics of it. I think there's, in 2010, there's a throttling subsystem which kind of has an idea about how much, or I guess how over throttling limit that you are, and it may base it on that. Previously, I think it just might be I can't remember if it's a single value or not. I'd have to look it up. But I guess we could follow up later on that.
What's the ROP pending? Can you explain that?
Okay. Yeah. So I guess one note about ROP backoff I should mention is the interaction with ROP release. Like, imagine if you have a case where you send a bunch of ROP releases to the server followed by query rows, and you get a ROP backoff immediately. Now, with ROP backoff, you don't actually know. The only way to know where in the stream you actually got the backoff is to see what results were returned before the ROP backoff. But we just mentioned the fact that ROP release didn't have any results returned. So that way, semantically, you have to assume the server has to do all ROP releases. The server cannot do a ROP backoff as a response to a ROP release. So that's the interaction between those two. And now going on to the ROP pending and ROP notify. They'll be covered a little bit more, I think, tomorrow. There's a notification section. But the ROP pending is to notify the client that there are still notifications present on this connection. So in 2007 and earlier, there was a concept of linked sessions. So the ROP pending could actually tell you if you're using this session that, hey, on this other session, here's the session ID. There are some notifications pending for you. In 2010 later, there is not the concept of linked sessions anymore, so you will only receive it at the end of a buffer to say, you might as well come back right away because I have more notifications for you.
When you send the async bit on for the ROP, then you can get a response for the task completion on the ROP ending, or you can get a status report. So, like,
I think you're thinking about ROP progress, not ROP pending.
Ah, yeah, thank you.
So ROP pending is, ROP pending is actually the.
Well, I don't know this one.
Next slide. So, ROP progress is another interesting one. It's not unlike the previous ones. There is both the request and the response, but. ROP progress is interesting in the fact that you can get it as a response to another ROP. So, as mentioned, there's a handful of ROPs which have this a want asynchronous parameter on it. This is a Boolean the client can pass in. The behavior with this is if the client passes in false for want asynchronous, it means the client wants the server to perform the entire operation to success or failure, and then return the response from the operation. If the client passes true for this, it says that the client is willing to have the server return early with some information to say this. I'm like halfway through. I'm 25% of the way through, and this is serialized as a ROP progress. So one example would be ROP empty folder. The client could send a ROP empty folder to the server with the want asynchronous being true, and the server could either decide that I can finish it right now. And finish it and send back the empty folder response, or it could actually return the ROP progress response, at which point the client would then send a ROP progress request to the server, and either the server would return another ROP progress with the updated progress, or it would return the actual final result of the ROP empty folder. So this is one thing I know that's been different between versions. One thing to note about this is the server is the one who gets to decide whether to return back the ROP progress or not. So it is the server's prerogative to just wait forever for it to, which was one of the differences between Exchange 2010 and SP1. The last two sections are not specific to ROPs, but kind of in general. The object release dependencies. So even among server objects themselves, there's some dependencies between them. One example of this is if you have a stream on a property of a message, this stream itself is kind of owned by the message. So when creating them, you have to, of course, create the message first, and then you open the stream of the message. When you release them, the client needs to release the stream before the message. And there's a whole list of these in the document.
I don't know in what scenarios the server could send a ROP progress, and if ROP progress could be a response for any ROP, any request ROP.
There's a listing of them. I think if you look through any of them that have this want asynchronous parameter, those are the only ones you can get ROP progress back for.
Right, and in what scenarios could the server decide to send a ROP progress?
Well, the server could. There's a couple different ways the server could do it. The server could immediately return it and say, well, you ask for progress, I'm going to immediately return you progress and spin off a separate thread to work on the operation. Or the server could decide, let me give the operation a couple seconds and then do it. Or the server could wait for a minute and do it. It depends on the logic of the server that way. It's flexible. The protocol itself is flexible with whatever the server decides.
Right. Thanks.
And I guess the last section I have is about code pages. So code pages are something that's specified on the EC do connect and also on a couple of ROPs such as open message, open embedded message. And the fields that this affects is if you ever have property values that are of type string 8. So this would be, I believe it's 1E, if in hex 1E. The string 8 type is actually just any sort of string that has one byte of null value at the end. So, for example, UTF-8 is a valid string A type, but UTF-16 would not be. So the way this works is if you, for example, have a table and you set columns on the table to a string A type, for let's say message class of string A type, you would get back the string A values when you did query rows on the table. There's also a couple other places where you see these string A types. One example I can think of is in ROP create, there's a flag followed by the folder description and also the folder comment. And this flag indicates whether the description and comment is actually in Unicode or the description comment is in string A. And they therefore would be encoded in the code page specified in doConnect. Or in the case of if you do get properties of a string A type, it would be if you ask for it on a message, it'd either be the code page on the connection that was specified in the connection, or it would be the code page that was specified on the open connect, depending on what was passed. I mean, open message, depending on what was passed in there. So to quickly go over some of the version differences, looking through 2003, 2007, 2010, there really wasn't any changes in the layout of ROP. So a ROP logon will look the same in all the versions. The return value is something that would be changing based on the version, because some servers may return a generic failure in this case, where other servers could return a more specific one. Example I can think of is, for example, logon. You might get logon failed on one version server. On the other hand, another version would give you this user is unrecognized, or these credentials are bad, or something. Same thing with handling of improper data. 2010 especially is a little bit more strict on this. 2007, 2003 might be a little bit lenient. If you had a ROP that, for example, a ROP that would pass in a logon handle or a server object handle for a logon, in some ways you could say that this isn't really necessary because the logon ID also signifies your logon. But 2010 would fail it if you pass in a bad server object handle, whereas 2007, 2003 might just silently succeed. The client also has made changes, so depending on the version of the client, you might see a different set of ROPs coming up based on other ones. Specifically, ROP buffer too small, ROP backoff are two changes of behavior. You could see ROP backoff is only supported by later clients. I think it's 2007, 2010 only supports it, and thus only 2007 and 2010 of the server side supports it. So if one of the clients or server is 2003, then you would not receive a ROP backoff, or you should not send a backoff to the client. Same thing with ROP buffer too small, in that the calculations to determine whether ROPs, the responses would fit, may be different based on the version of the server. Some might be a bit more conservative than others. I think there's Appendix A of the MSOX CROPS document, which does describe some of the differences. I think there's some fields that are initialized to zero in like 2010, but may not be in earlier versions. And next, we just have a quick sample. The sample I have here does not contain the first two bytes of the size and doesn't contain the server object handle, but just contains pretty much a group of six ROPs that the client sent to the server. So just to go through parsing this. So in parsing it, you just would look at the first byte in this case, which is a 5. 5, you know, is ROP get contents table. You know ROP get contents table is 6 bytes, or 5 bytes, so you know exactly how long it is. And you can easily look at the first byte here, being the logon ID, followed by the input server object handle, followed by the output server object handle index, and finally some flags. So in this case, this is a get contents table on some sort of object that wants the associated table. 2 stands for associate here. The next ROP in the list would be 12, which is the set columns, which contains the same sort of header here. Some flags, followed by the fact that there are 6 columns. And you can see all the columns here. The interesting thing about this is the type, which is the first 2 bytes. In this case, you have 3 of them in a row, which are 14, which is a 64-bit integer, followed by a 3, which is, pardon? That's a long. And then 1F, which is a Unicode string, and a file time, I believe. Or system time. Yeah, that's right, file time. So that's pretty much payload of ROP set columns. So as soon as you're done parsing that, you can go on to the next one, restrict. So going through one by one, this is just a restriction for C4, which is a property restriction, and it's looking at the string column, which is message class, and you can tell right here this is a Unicode string, so I can't remember what this is. This might be junk mail, but it's one of them. Next, you have the sort table and seek row. Each one of them just has its own payload. This is sorting by last modification time. I think it's descending. The seek row, just the origin is zero, so it would go to the beginning. And finally, you have a query rows, which asks for 1,000 hex different rows. So this case right here, you see an example of the actual pipeline incurring. The client is able to send both the git contents table and all the subsequent operations on it, and actually get the query rows back for the table. Let's quickly go through the response. Most of the responses are pretty boilerplate. Git contents table, you have the usual 5 at the beginning. The 1 is the output handle index in this case, and all the operations past that point use the same index, so they're all working on the same table. All of them contain 0 for the status. Flags are 0 for most of them. I guess this is returning the number of rows in the contents table. And this is an example of where, to parse this successfully, you need to know the order of the columns. So in this case, you can skip ahead to, I believe, so at this point, see, this is the ROP ID followed by the handle index, and then you have the 4 zeros for the status result. After that, you have things of flags, and then you have the number of rows included here, which is 1. I believe at this point you have the first value. So these 8 bytes followed by these 8 bytes, followed by these 8 bytes. And then you have 4 for the long, followed by the Unicode string. And finally you see the 0 termination for the Unicode string, followed by the file time. That's pretty much all I have, so any questions about ROPs?
Any reason why the size field is not there in our program?
Like that parsing would be a lot easier, isn't it?
Well, this was written a long time ago, and I'm guessing it was written long enough ago where they were worried about bytes in the wire. So this is why ROPs did not include the size, and this is why query rows wouldn't actually include the columns along with all the data on it. So it's just one of those things that I guess we have to live with.
Yeah, I was talking to that Netmon guy, and for them, parsing is difficult because of this variable size.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because there's no way to just take a buffer and parse it as is, especially if there's a query rows inside of it, because you have to know what has happened in the past. So
yeah, that's what I'm telling you. If you have the size, at least you can have the you go to the next one. At least you can see which are the ROPs in the request and response.
Yes. So it also gets interesting also with, for example, the example I gave with the set message flags, where you have to know the log on, the type. So imagine a situation where you get the log on
private or public
in the same buffer as the set message flag. So you almost have to actually look at the beginning of the buffer to be able to parse the end of the buffer and know what kind of flags are passed along there too.
So if the server fails an operation, a ROP operation in the middle somewhere, what's the semantics, failure semantics? Does it continue on to finish all the ROPs? What's the client retry logic for this case?
So it depends on the failure. So if the failure is just this operation failed, such as you don't have access to this folder, then the response will just be a failure response for that specific ROP. And then the server can continue on with the subsequent ROPs. In the example I just gave here, so in this case, let's say the git contents table failed. Let's say you just passed in a bad handle for the first one. In this case, the server will continue with the rest of them, set columns, restrict sort table, but then each one will get a failure of, I think, null object, because the server object that is being referenced here ends up pointing to something that was never initialized because the first one failed. Now, if the failure is something such as RPC format. So if the server doesn't understand the format anymore, then that effectively becomes a RPC failure, where the server throws away everything and just returns failure on the RPC request itself. RPC format, I think it is.
So if there was a write to a stream or something like that, you could do it, or what?
So if there's a write to a stream...
Like, let's say you have a rope buffer with a write, and a release, and something that you...
don't understand the rope buffer anymore. So you have write, release, and...
followed by garbage,
some garbage. Like, so will the server undo the write? What's the semantic?
It's kind of undefined. So in 2007 and earlier... I think it may actually execute the earlier ones, 2010 and later. I think it looks through the entire buffer first before it decides whether to execute anything.
Do a two-pass kind of a thing?
Yes. So the idea is also, because when you fail the RPC, you don't actually pass back any output. The client has no idea whether you actually executed anything or not when you fail the RPC. Similar thing with ROP backoff. So there's two ways of backing off a client. You can either use ROP backoff, or you could throw an RPC exception. Same sort of thing. So if you throw the RPC exception, you wouldn't return any information, so it's probably better to return or throw the exception at the beginning of processing, so the client doesn't assume that, or the client knows whether you actually execute anything or not. Well, that's all. Thank you.